This is John Daly in the radio newsroom of the United States Senate. It is 2 p.m. here in Washington, this 1st of March, 1805, and in 15 minutes, Samuel Chase, Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court, may be removed from the bench, convicted of high crimes and misdemeanors. In 15 minutes, the question of the hour will be decided, whether impeachment proceedings can be used for partisan political purposes, and whether the United States Supreme Court can remain independent of politics. At 2:15 precisely, Vice President Aaron Burr will mount the rostrum, reconvene the Senate as a court of impeachment, and each senator in turn will cast his
March 1st, 1805, Washington, D.C. You are there.
Samuel Chase, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, is impeached. The independence of our highest judicial tribunal is at stake. CBS takes you back 144 years to the little-known but important trial that determined the role played today in our nation's life by the United States Supreme Court. All things are as they were then, except for one thing. When CBS is there...
You are there.
You Are There, produced and directed by Robert Louis Cheyenne, is based on authentic historical fact and quotation. And now...
The radio newsroom of the United States Senate and John Daly.
It's been debated ever since the Constitution was created and ratified by the states 16 years ago. The question is to exactly what relationship our Supreme Court has to the Congress and the presidency. The article to be voted is the 8th and the last article in the charges brought by the House of Representatives against Justice Chase. If the Jeffersonian Republicans, now in control of the Congress, fail to convict Justice Chase on this final count, the trial will be over and the Supreme Court will have weathered this first crucial test young Korea. Seven times during these impeachment proceedings, on the seven previous articles, the Jeffersonians, because of defections in their own ranks, have failed to obtain the 23 votes necessary for conviction. Five Republican senators have consistently voted with the 9 Federalist senators for acquittal. These five Jeffersonian Republicans are Senator Bradley of Vermont, Senator Mitchell of New York, and the 3 Senators Smith, Israel Smith of Vermont, John Smith of New York, and John Smith of Ohio. At this very moment, Senator Giles of Virginia, the administration whip, is holding a last-minute party caucus in a committee room on the second floor of the Senate wing. Senator Giles and his confreres are using every argument in their power to swing these recalcitrant senators into line. Congressman John Randolph of Virginia, manager of impeachment for the House of Representatives, has just come out of that committee room. Ken Roberts is with him, so go ahead, Roberts.
Congressman Randolph, have your administration colleagues in the committee room been able to change the minds of Senators Bradley, Mitchell, and the 3 Smiths? Will they vote for conviction?
If they don't, sir, I tell you this. If they don't, then this country of ours will witness a wave of judicial tyranny that will drown our republic. I tell you this, sir. Chase must be convicted. Decency, morality, liberty demands his conviction.
Yes, but Congressman Randolph, have any of the 5 senators switched?
They will, sir. They will.
But have they said so? Have they made any statement to that effect?
The air is full of statements.
But, Congressman, if these 5 have refused to vote Justice Chase guilty on the first 7 articles, what makes you think they will switch on this 8th and last article?
The first 7 articles of impeachment dealt with the behavior of the estimable judge while he was on the bench. Perhaps being on the bench wraps a man in an aura of righteousness that even truth and justice can't pierce. I don't pretend to understand why they voted as they did. I'm not a magician. But be that as it may, this time they will have the chance to square their debt to posterity by voting this evil man down on this 8th count.
But, Congressman, this 8th count has nothing to do with Justice Chase's behavior on the bench during a trial.
That's it, exactly. This 8th article attacks Chase at his most vulnerable point. His absolute unfitness to sit in judgment in any court of law. This man, this wicked, profane man, addressing a grand jury in Baltimore, said, and I quote, "The bulk of mankind are governed by their passions and not by reason. Universal suffrage will take away all security for property and personal liberty." I continue to quote Justice Chase. "The doctrine that all men are entitled to enjoy equal liberty and equal rights has brought nothing but mischief upon us." That, sir, is no European autocrat speaking, no czar, no courtier.
How much control shall Congress and the President have over the Supreme Court? In contrast, The Federalists literally exude confidence. In the 2 hours since this recess began, the chief actor in this judicial drama, Justice Samuel Chase, along with his counsel and a number of Federalist senators, have been enjoying a leisurely lunch at the Indian Queen boarding house just across the road from the Capitol. Don Hollenbeck is at the Indian Queen, so go ahead, Hollenbeck.
Justice Chase left the Indian Queen a moment ago to return to the Capitol. We asked him to speak with us, but he declined. But Luther Martin, his chief counsel, has remained behind. He and his associates have been having a sort of pre-victory gala here. Mr. Martin, as you know, is the prominent Baltimore attorney who, during the 3 weeks of the impeachment proceedings, has captured the admiration of all Washington with his brilliant defense of Justice Chase. President Jefferson, though, doesn't share that admiration, and he's on record as having referred to Mr. Martin, and I'm quoting now, as an impudent and unprincipled Federalist bulldog, end of quote.
Yeah, you're wrong, sir. Correction, sir. You have the order. First, our esteemed president referred to me as an unprincipled and impudent Federalist bulldog.
I'm sorry, I stand corrected, Mr. Martin. I suppose you know that the Republican senators are in caucus now trying to get the three Senator Smiths, Senators Bradley and Mitchell, to vote for conviction.
To no avail, sir. Those five staunch patriots will not be swayed by promises of political aggrandizement. Not one of them will vote Justice Chase guilty, not one.
All right, now just what do you mean by promises of political aggrandizement?
Bribes. Bribes. Jefferson and his cohorts have been bribing everybody within reach. Look what they've done with Aaron Burr. Aaron Burr, the man who once almost grabbed the presidency from under Jefferson's nose. Aaron Burr, a man now under indictment for murder in the state of New Jersey for his killing of Alexander Hamilton. Aaron Burr, yet now a welcome visitor at the executive mansion. Now the recipient of all presidential favors. And his stepson. What have they done with his stepson? Tell me, eh?
Yes, he's on the bench at New Orleans.
Yeah. And his brother-in-law?
Secretary to Louisiana Territory.
Right. Burr's bosom friend, Wilkinson, made governor of the Louisiana Territory, eh? And Senator Giles scurrying around with a petition begging the governor of New Jersey not to prosecute the murder charge against Burr. And why this sudden tremendous affection for the vice president?
Well, why?
Because he has influence, so it is thought, with Senator John Smith of Ohio and Senator John Smith of New York. Bribes, sir, but to no avail. The Smiths will still vote for acquittal.
Well, what about Senators Bradley and Mitchell? Do you think they'll switch on the 8th article?
Look here, my friend. Justice Chase may have been indiscreet in his remarks to the grand jury in Baltimore, but he is not criminally liable for an indiscretion. If an indiscretion, sir, were a high crime, all of us would spend half our lives behind bars.
That's right, Counselor, but the administration claims it's not necessary to prove a crime in order to remove a judge from the bench. Congressman Randolph said that a moment ago.
Congressman Randolph knows less law than the overseer of his plantation. The Constitution is wonderfully clear on this point. A Supreme Court judge may be removed from office for high crimes and misdemeanors. For high crimes and misdemeanors. For nothing else.
Well, now let's get a little deeper into this question. Yes, the administration maintains that if a Supreme Court judge can't be removed unless guilty of a crime, the High Court could be turned into a tribunal beyond the reach of the people.
Theoretical, sir. I'm not interested in theoretical arguments. I am interested in law. The law states high crimes and misdemeanors are the only basis upon which a federal judge can be removed. It was up to the House managers to prove high crimes and misdemeanors against Justice Chase. This they failed utterly to do. This they failed miserably to do. Now, sir, the voting is about to begin. I must leave the Indian Queen.
Thank you, Mr. Luther Martin. And now back to John Daly in the Capitol.
Mr. Martin at the Indian Queen boarding house seemed reluctant to comment on the possibility that the Supreme Court, beyond the reach of the people, may become a despotic tribunal unless it's possible to remove a justice from the bench for political as well as for criminal reasons. Of course, the Federalists have a point of view on this deep and underlying issue that goes right to the roots of our constitutional system. It has been most ably stated by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Marshall, and here is Quincy Howe to analyze that point of view.
Chief Justice Marshall and the Federalists believe that the Supreme Court is and should be independent of politics and of both Congress and the President. They say that the court stands on an equal footing with the legislative and executive branches of our government, that it completes the tripod on which our political structure stands. Of course, the main issue now at point is whether the court has power to void acts of Congress on constitutional grounds. The Constitution does not explicitly grant such power to the court. However, as the Chief Justice points out, Hamilton, Madison, and other framers of the Constitution stated again and again that the Supreme Court has this power. And Marshall goes on to say that no political structure can endure unless it rests on law, and that no law can endure unless one final court has the power to interpret that law's meaning. President Jefferson and his supporters reply that ours is a government of the people. The Jeffersonian Republicans have a deep and sincere fear of the Supreme Court, because it is the one arm of our government that is not directly responsible to the people. The people do not elect the judges to office. The president appoints them, and they remain on the bench for life. This raises the possibility that at some future time, a few venal, despotic individuals on the Supreme Court might use it to check social and political progress. Of course, Chief Justice Marshall and the Federalists have no such fears. Our government, I must repeat, stands on a delicate tripod of checks and balances, the President, Congress, and the Court. The recent history of England under King George III shows the danger of an all-powerful executive. The recent history of France under Bonaparte shows how easily a tyrant can subvert a popular revolution. Our Supreme Court checks both the power of the executive and the power of the people's representatives in Congress. But our Supreme Court cannot permanently block the people's wills. As Marshall and the Federalists point out, it is always possible to get around the Supreme Court decision by amending the Constitution. Another way would be for the President to appoint additional justices to the Supreme Bench, as he can do with the consent of Congress. The Federalists also argue that the power of the Supreme Court to defy the popular will is further restricted by the fact that the court cannot initiate new laws or even pass on existing laws unless appealed to by some party seeking legal redress. And finally, perhaps the most cogent Federalist argument, as time passes and members of the court die, new justices replace them. That is... Ken Roberts, outside the Senate committee room, reports that the administration caucus has broken up. So go ahead, Ken Roberts.
The Republican senators are leaving the committee room. They're on their way to the Senate chamber. There's been no official statement on the result of the caucus. We don't know as yet whether or not the... Oh, there's Senator Bradley of Vermont, one of the five holdouts. Oh, Senator, Senator Bradley.
Sorry, no statement. I'm sorry.
But, Senator,
sorry, no questions, no comments, no comments.
Senator Bradley has walked by us. He has refused to answer any questions. Oh, now here are the Smiths, the three Senator Smiths. They're coming out together. Gentlemen, please, can you tell us how you will vote?
Not now.
Would you switch over to the guilty column on this last article?
Sorry, not now.
Senator Israel Smith of Vermont.
Well, it seems to me that...
Yes, Senator.
No statement. I'm sure you realize that at this time it's not necessary.
Senator Giles of Virginia, the Republican whip snatched the three senators away from us. We had hoped that... Oh, Senator Mitchell. Senator, how would you vote, sir? Would you vote Chase guilty on this last count?
Well, I've been through a very exhausting experience. My colleagues, whose opinions I respect thoroughly, have spent the last 2 hours trying to convince me of the error of my ways. They've offered many forceful arguments, many.
Yes, I know, but have they convinced you, Senator?
I don't like Chase. I must make that clear. I think he's a thoroughly despicable character, completely unfit to sit on the bench of the Supreme Court. I disagree with his political theories as passionately as possible. But if I were to vote him guilty, I would be an instrument in wrecking our entire mechanism of government.
Senator, do you believe the Supreme Court should remain independent?
Yes, if this government is to survive, it must. I believe that if we, here and now, establish the precedent that a judge can be removed from the bench because of his political beliefs, then, sir, I think we will be destroying the balance of our constitutional system.
Well, you still haven't told us how you intend to vote, Senator.
This is a case where one must vote principle above party and personality. I will maintain my position. I will vote not guilty on this 8th article. Oh, now the session is about to begin. I beg your leave, sir.
Senator Mitchell will vote not guilty. The senator will vote for acquittal. Now here's John Daly in the news section on the floor of the Senate chamber. The
Senate is about to convene. The last act in this dramatic and historic trial is about to begin. With Senator Mitchell of New York on record for acquittal, the Jeffersonian Republicans now have only 4 chances to get the 3 votes they need for conviction. The votes of Senator Bradley of Vermont and the 3 Senators Smith, Smith of Vermont, Smith of New York, and Smith of Ohio. The setting here emphasizes the solemnity, the drama of the hour. The Senate chamber has been transformed into a vast stage that might well be fitted to the staging of some great Shakespearean tragedy. The chair of the presiding officer, Vice President Aaron Burr, is set against the rear wall, and on its right and left, like 2 crimson wings, the red leather benches occupied by the senators extend the whole width of the chamber. In front of the Vice President, on the right, is a section where the House managers are seated. To the left, in a similar enclosure, Justice Samuel Chase and his counsel are now waiting for the session to begin. Justice Chase is a tall, heavy-set man of 64, and at the moment, he has his glasses perched on his forehead, a typical habit of his. He seems calm and confident. The floor of the Senate chamber has been given over to the members of the House of Representatives, foreign diplomats, and various government officials. Behind them, a new gallery has been erected, especially for the ladies and for the families of public officers. There's not a seat to be had, not a single one anywhere. And now the Vice President, Aaron Burr, has come in through a side door, is taking his chair. Silence has come over the Senate chamber. There's the gavel over to the Vice President's chair.
The Sergeant-at-Arms will make proclamation.
Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons are commanded to keep silence on pain of imprisonment when the grand inquest of the nation is exhibiting to the Senate of the United States, sitting as a court of impeachment, articles of impeachment against Samuel Chase, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States.
Before we proceed to the voting on the 8th and last article of impeachment, I must admonish again the citizens and strangers in the galleries that absolute silence and perfect order are required. This chair will tolerate no demonstrations of any kind, and the perpetrators of any such misbehavior will be surely and severely punished.
Mr. President, sir.
Senator Giles, Jeffersonian Republican.
Gentlemen
of Virginia.
Virginia, recognized.
I move you, sir, that we proceed to vote on the 8th article of impeachment as brought for the House of Representatives against Samuel Chase, Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court.
Is there any objection? It is so ordered. Senators, in conformity with the order of the Senate, the chair will now proceed to take the vote on the 8th article as directed. The secretary will read the 8th article.
Article 8. And whereas the said Samuel Chase, disregarding the duties and dignities of his judicial character, did at a circuit court for the District of Maryland, held at Baltimore on the 9th of May, 1803, pervert his official right and duty to address the grand jury on matters coming within the province of said jury, for the purpose of delivering to the said grand jury an intemperate and inflammatory political harangue, a conduct highly censurable in any, but peculiarly indecent and unbecoming a judge of the Supreme Court of the United States, and moreover, then and there, did, in a manner highly unwarrantable, endeavor to excite the odium of the said grand jury and of the good people of Maryland against the government of the United States by delivering opinions which, as delivered by him, were highly indecent, extrajudicial, and tending to prostitute the high judicial character with which he was invested to the low purposes of an electioneering partisan.
The secretary has finished reading the familiar 8th article. The roll is about to be called. Once again, remember, the Jeffersonian Republicans need 23 votes to convict. They're certain of 20. They must get 3 more, and they must get those 3 from Bradley and the 3 Smiths. The first man to watch is Senator Bradley, and here's the roll call.
Adams. Mr. Senator John Quincy Adams, how say you?
is Samuel Chase guilty or not guilty of a high crime or misdemeanor, as charged in the article just read?
Not guilty.
Anderson?
Guilty.
Baldwin?
Guilty.
Bayard?
Not guilty.
Bradley is next.
Bradley?
Not guilty.
Senator Bradley has voted not guilty and refused to follow his party, and that leaves only the three Smiths who can save the day for the Republicans unless there is an unexpected switch by some senator.
Breckinridge?
Guilty.
Brown?
Guilty.
Cop?
Guilty.
Condit?
Guilty.
Ellery?
Guilty.
Franklin?
No change so far. 8 guilty, 3 not guilty, 23 needed for conviction.
Gaylord.
Not guilty.
Giles.
Guilty.
Hillhouse.
Not guilty.
Howland.
Guilty.
Jackson.
Guilty.
11 guilty, 5 not guilty.
Logan.
Guilty.
McClay.
Guilty.
Mitchell.
Not guilty.
As he said he would, Senator Mitchell has voted not guilty now. It's up to the Smiths. If any one of them votes not guilty, Justice Chase will be acquitted. The rest of the roll call will then be a mere formality.
Moore.
Guilty.
Alcott.
Not guilty.
Pickering.
Not guilty.
14 guilty, 8 not guilty.
Plummer.
Not guilty.
Here come the deciding votes. Here come the Smiths.
Israel Smith of Vermont.
Not guilty.
Not guilty. Not guilty. Chase is acquitted irrespective of how the voting may go from here on in. It's a formality. Justice Chase is not guilty. The impeachment fails. Chief Justice John Marshall and the Supreme Court have won a smashing victory over President Thomas Jefferson and the Jeffersonian Republicans. Undoubtedly, a precedent has been set here today, which will place
the country beyond 1805.
Independence.
The impeachment of Justice Samuel Chase fails, and the traditional role of the United States Supreme Court as an independent branch of our government is established.
You have been listening to The Impeachment of Supreme Court Justice Samuel Chase, another broadcast in the series You Are There, produced and directed by Robert Louis Cheyenne. The Impeachment of Samuel Chase was written by Irv Tunick. Congressman John Randolph was played by Anthony Kemble Cooper, Luther Martin by Scott Scottsworth, Senator Mitchell by William Podmore, and the cast included Gavin Gordon, Guy Sorrell, Peter Hobbs, Mercy McLeod, Bert Cowlin, Abe Vigoda, Alfred De La Fuente, and others. Next week,
April 19, 1775. Lexington, Concord, and Merriam's Corner. You are there.
Mother's Day is a splendid idea for mothers, but it can be rough on fathers and sons. And to find out how rough, you have only to wait for the adventures of Ozzie and Harriet later today. While Harriet sits and waits for her Mother's Day presents, Ozzie discovers that their two sons, Ricky and David, have beaten him to the punch by shopping early, and he finds it necessary to bargain with them before Mother's Day in the Nelson household resembles the ads. You'll thoroughly enjoy this latest of the adventures of Ozzie and Harriet when it comes to you this evening on most of these same CBS stations. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.